Okay, Daniel chapter 1. Last week, we basically just covered verse 1 and all the background that goes into verse 1. I love pop quizzes, so let's do a little pop quiz. All right, let's read verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. What year did that take place? Whoa! Good job. Who said that? How did you know? Oh, you cheater. Don't look in the study Bibles. You weren't even here last Sunday night. I was like, how did she know that? So, King Jehoiakim, okay. What was his given Hebrew name? Does anybody remember? Starts with an E. Oh, I'm going to stump everybody. Oh, no, it's not. Try it, Linda. Eliakim, good. In Hebrew, it probably would have been Eliakim, but that's no big deal. So, how many times did Nebuchadnezzar come against Jerusalem? I said that they besieged the city in three phases. Well, I just gave the answer away. Doggone it. Three. Okay. It is. Okay. Okay. All right. Last pop quiz. Okay, so the kingdom of Judah was in league with what country against Babylon? Actually, what two countries? Huh? Egypt was one. Boy, bonus brownie points if you can give me the Pharaoh's actual name. Necho, good job. Okay. And who was running from the Babylonians into the arms of the Egyptians and the Jews? The Assyrians. That's right. The same people that took away the 10 northern tribes 150 years earlier were now on the run. So let's do this. Let's read all of chapter 1, not in unison. I'll read it. And y'all follow along. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. I bet Nebuchadnezzar didn't realize that that happened. But who really gave the victory there? The Lord did. With some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them in the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah he called Shadrach. Mishael he called Meshach. And Azariah he called Abednego. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you. and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. And you know what? We're just going to stop there. We'll cover verses 17 and following next week. So what are the basics? If you were going to outline this and just kind of hit the highlights and say, what are the facts of this chapter? And I think anytime you're trying to study the Bible for yourself, that's really where you have to begin. Don't foist on the scripture some interpretation that you think it says. Get the facts straight first, because a lot of times interpretations that we carry into a passage are interpretations. You know, it might be something that I heard when I was in Sunday school years ago, and my Sunday school teacher was some seventh grade boy, right? Because the teacher was out that week or whatever. What do seventh grade boys, no offense, guys, what do seventh grade boys know about the Bible? No, y'all aren't in seventh. I'm really offending this table right now. I'm sorry, guys. But really, get the facts straight first. A lot of times, our ideas about what a passage says are wrong because we carry our own ideas into that passage. And then sometimes we read the passage and say, wow, if I'd have paid attention to what it actually said, maybe I would have a different opinion. So what are the facts of this chapter? Well, it begins with defeat. Look at verse 2. It says, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand the vessels of the house of God. Look at how many other times the other God is mentioned. He brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Daniel didn't have to write that in there. He put that in there for our understanding. The book of Daniel is not really about Daniel. Who's it about? Who's it about? Is the book of Daniel about Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Is it the story of a struggle between the holy Hebrews and the defiled Babylons? It is a story of a struggle, but the story of a struggle between who? God on one hand and false gods on the other. That's the real struggle. And Daniel sets that off right at the very beginning. Now we see that some of the people of exile of God are exiled, with particular people targeted. Look at verses 3 through 7. Out of all the exiles, it says in verse 3 that the king wanted Ashpenaz, his right-hand man, to target the absolute highest quality Hebrew boys to bring into the king's court. And I've noted there where they tried to draw these Hebrew boys from. Royal family, the nobility. Just thinking out loud here, y'all help me out. Why would he target royal youths and noble youths to bring into the king's court? Why would Nebuchadnezzar do that? Can you think of any reasons? They're educated. That's right. He doesn't have to teach them to read before he teaches them to read Chaldean. What's another reason that might be? Think of a political reason. What might be a political reason he would do that? Ooh, wow, that's bingo, right on the head. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar at this point is being nice dictator. He hasn't brought the hammer down on Jerusalem just yet. That comes 18 years later. He's trying to play good cop. There's lots of Jewish nobility still in the land or brought with them. What better way to ensure that they're going to comply with your demands and not rebel? I've got your kids. Nebuchadnezzar knew what he was doing. Verse 4 tells us that they were good looking. I'm not sure why that was important to Nebuchadnezzar, but maybe it was just an image thing. Verse 4 tells us, and it tells us in many different ways, that they were knowledgeable. And, you know, I almost put the word mental flexibility. Look at these. Look at the way it's described. Skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning. I mean, that's a lot to unpack. But when I try to boil it down, I look at it and I think they already are smart and they're able to learn quickly. They're flexible. And the last thing is that look at what it says here at the end of verse 4. They were competent to stand in the king's palace. They were young men of poise. They could stand in front of not just anybody, but in front of a king and not wet themselves, right? I mean, that takes it. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar, it would be kind of nerve-wracking to go in front of the president of the United States now in an official capacity. If you were just visiting the White House, that's not a big deal. But if you were called to see the president, or maybe think of it another way, if you got a summons to appear before a judge, you'd be a little nervous. Well, what's the worst the judge would do to you? Unless it was a capital crime, he may throw you in jail for a night. He may give you a fine. He may give you a warning. These guys back then, they had no problem. If they didn't like you, off with your head. You know. So these guys, they had a lot of poise. Now notice in verse 5, that speaking of, remember, Daniel and the boys haven't been introduced yet. The king assigned them, who? All of the boys, all of the Hebrew boys that came through, assigned them what to eat and what to drink, and they were to undergo a period of 3 years. And at the end of the 3 years, I suppose Nebuchadnezzar was going to say, "Well, I like you. I don't like you. I like you. I don't like you." And I don't know what happened to him if he didn't like him at the end of 3 years, but it probably wasn't good. So we also see that Daniel and his friends Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Let's say those names together. You know, one of the things that church people, listen, guys, this is our book, right? This is our book. I know English is our common tongue, but we need to learn how to say these names if we're going to read it and read it well. So let's say it together. Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. Very well done. Well done. And then they were given Babylonian names. So let's talk about the name game real quick. Why did that happen? Why was Daniel called Belteshazzar, Hananiah Shadrach, Mishael Meshach, and Azariah Abednego? Well, what are your thoughts? We talked about this a little bit last week, but what are your thoughts, Katie? Ah, so Katie, all right, so this is a good, we're going to work on my our biblical interpretation skills. Katie has proposed a theory, and I love it when people just speak out. I love it. There's no such thing as a stupid proposal. We are just going to work through it. The theory is that the Hebrew boys were hiding, maybe trying to conceal their Hebrew identity. Is that right? The boys took on the identity, or the king was hiding them? What's your theory, Kate? The king? Okay. What do we think of that theory, guys? Sounds good? All right, so I'm going to poke a hole in it. Let's just ask a question. Why would the king, and if somebody's got an answer, let's do it. Let's do it. Why would the king seek to hide the Hebrew boys' identity? Protect. That's a different theory. What'd you say, buddy? Well, I think that's fair to assume. Probably. Good answer. That's it. Right. So, I appreciate that jumping out there, Katie. But I think the answers have been hit on here. They wanted, remember the illustration I gave last week of gang members? We talked about that. That's not in the notes. So somebody asked me for the notes and I emailed it to them. So that's not in there. When you're assimilated into a gang, what do they give you? They give you a new name. They'll even tattoo you up with tattoos. Mexican gangs are really bad about putting tattoos on the face. Do you know why they do that? Not only to mark them, but they cannot hide who they are anymore. And unless they go to extreme lengths to get rid of those tattoos, they will never get a job. And so then they have to stay in the gang. So, but what Nebuchadnezzar was doing, and not just with the Hebrews, every culture he assimilated, he'd give them new names. Now, I want you to look at this little chart. I think this is pretty cool. It's not cool. It's fascinating. So Daniel's name, what did Daniel's name mean? God is my judge. That's right. What does Belshazzar mean? Not Jehovah. You see the name Bel in Belshazzar? Okay. So then we got Hananiah. The Lord shows grace. What a wonderful name. Shadrach. Under the command of Aku, a moon god. By the way, this has nothing to do with our study. But before Allah became the one God of Islam, he was one of several hundred gods worshipped by Arabian peoples. And do you know who Allah was? What does their flag look like? He was the moon god. I'm not saying it was this guy right here, but in every culture, going back as far as you can count, there is a moon god. Anyway, Mishael, who is what God is? Don't you love these names? His name says nobody's like God. And so what did they name him? Who is what Aku is? It's like in your face. And Azariah means what? Lord helps. Abednego, you're not a servant of the Lord anymore. You're a servant of Nebo now. So that's why they gave him new names, in the hopes that maybe not with them, but with their children, because they would have to give them Babylonian names as well. The culture war isn't always won on this level, is it? Where is it won? Next level, and next level, and next level. Just look at the book of Joshua to see that. Joshua goes in, takes care of everything. The people are following the Lord. As soon as he dies, what happens? Next level down. It says there arose a generation that did not know the Lord, and they immediately began to worship idols. It's crazy. That's why it's so important that you drag your kids to church. I know parents that say, oh, I couldn't get them out of bed. I feel like saying, what? What? I'm the daddy in my house. I don't know about y'all. I tell my kids what to do. Get your butt up. Follow me. So let me ask you this question, a little application. How would you like to have your name changed so that its meaning announces that you honor and love something that you don't actually honor and love? What would that be like? Oh, good word. Say that louder. It's degrading. Man, especially to people. Remember we talked about this morning a little bit. In that culture, names meant a lot more than they do in our culture. That's why when we do this today, we talk about nicknames. Like Mad Dog or whatever. They're not thinking about God. Think about this. The Jews, it really is. All of this really is evidence of God's providence in holding the Jewish people and religion together during exile, right? Because the Jewish people's religion was centered around a temple. A temple located where? In Jerusalem. They are hundreds of miles away from this temple. Their names are being changed. They don't have Levites to teach them anymore. How did they hold on to this religion? There is only one answer. God. Anyway, so that's why he changed their names. Let's flip over and take a look at this episode with the king's food. I find this fascinating. It says over and over in verses 1 through 7, or actually the whole verses 1 through 16, that it was the king's food, the king's food, the king's food. So what do you think that means? And I know I wrote it down, but you know, in your own words, what would you say? Are they eating bologna? You know, my father loves fried bologna. Anytime he finds a restaurant that serves fried bologna, he gets it. But I don't think even he would argue that filet mignon is better than fried bologna. They were not eating bologna. They were eating the good stuff. They weren't drinking the worst wine. They were drinking the best wine. Now, I've heard several theories on why. Look at verse 8. Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine. Now, do not read ahead. Do not read ahead. Or with the wine that he drank. Of course, y'all are just like school kids. I say, don't think about a pink elephant. And what's you're immediately reading ahead, probably. That's okay. So I've heard different theories on why this is. The most popular and certainly valid one is that first bullet there. Do y'all know what I'm talking about? Turn back to Leviticus chapter 11. We'll just take a brief look at it. Leviticus chapter 11. It's kind of boring for us to read chapters like this because in the book of Acts, Peter sees a vision from God. And praise God, he did. Because in that vision, Peter is told that everything is now on the menu. And isn't that good? That sausage and bacon we had yesterday, both would have been off limits back in the old days, in the Jewish old days. So we don't have to follow that. But the Jews did, and we're not going to read all of this. I'll just read the first verse. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying to them, speak to the people of Israel, saying, these are the living things that you may eat among all the animals that are on the earth. And then the whole chapter describes animals that they may and may not eat. Now, that's kind of tedious to us today, especially on this side of grace, where we don't, even Jewish people today, don't have to follow that. Who was the vision given to? Peter, a Jew. So these laws are not applicable to us anymore. And so one theory goes like this. The king's food consisted of a lot of the do-nots in Leviticus chapter 11. Now, does that sound plausible? It does, doesn't it? I think that is very valid. I think that's very valid. I even read one theory that said the Hebrew boys were declaring their independence of the king. We're not dependent on you for anything. My problem with that theory is they still ate the king's vegetables, apparently. So, unless they grew a garden real quick, and the Bible doesn't tell us that happened. Now, I believe I have really strong evidence for my theory. I believe the reason they didn't eat is this. They did not want to sanction idolatry. Anybody ever heard this before? Boy, I feel like I'm going way out on a limb here. When nobody hears it, except for one or two hands, I get nervous. It's like, this is new. Oh, no. Let's turn back to Numbers chapter 25. I want to show you something. Your fourth book in your Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. The children of Israel are marching towards the River Jordan. I did. This is just after the false prophet Balaam failed in his bid to curse the people of Israel. Do you remember that? Something he did not fail in is tripping up the Israelites another way. Look at verse 1, Numbers 25. While Israel lived in Shittim, The people began to whore with the daughters of Moab. These, that is, the daughters of Moab, invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. What did the people do? They ate. So what was included in the sacrifices of their gods? Meals, feasting. Now, that's not a foreign concept, is it? The children of Israel did the very same thing, right? Time and time again, they are told, sacrifice this, and then either you eat it or the priest eats it. They were always eating what they sacrificed. Another place where a similar idea is Judges chapter 9 and verse 27. This is a lesser known story of a rebel named Abimelech. Abimelech was the son of Gideon. The son of Gideon. And Gideon had told the people, I do not want to be king. They tried to crown him as king. And Gideon said, I don't want it. God said, we're not supposed to have kings. And remember, they didn't have kings yet at this point in their history. But Gideon dies, and then his son Abimelech says, hey, I want it. I want it. So look at what happens in verse 27 of chapter 9, if I can find it in my Bible. And they went out into the field and gathered the grapes from their vineyards and trod them, so they're making wine. And they held a what? They held a festival, so they're definitely going to eat, right? And they went into the house of their God. And they ate and drank, and they cursed the name of Abimelech. My point in bringing up these two passages is this. It was not out of the ordinary. In fact, it was common for people back then, while they were worshiping false gods, to do what? To sacrifice. And so here's what they would do. They sacrificed what they wanted to eat to their God. And that was the sacrifice part. And then they said, well, may as well not let all this good meat go to waste. And then they would eat it in a big feast. But in sacrificing it to their God, they are consecrating that meat to that God. Now, the reason I feel so strongly about why this is why Daniel did not eat the meat, I want to take you to the New Testament, to a place you're probably not going to expect. But I want you to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. During the early church, this was still a problem. The Jews were not offering sacrifices to false gods anymore, but who was? Everybody around them. The Romans, Greeks, barbarians. Now, just to drive the point home, do y'all's Bibles have little subject headings above the chapters? What does it say above chapter 10? Stuff about, okay, I heard the word idolatry. Anybody else see something like that in your Bible? Okay, it is definitely that. Okay. And you, Linda? Okay. That's all true. The beginning part of 1 Corinthians 10, Paul is giving examples of how Israel sinned, but he's giving them examples of how they sinned in one particular way. What way? Idolatry. Now, go down to verse 23. All things are lawful, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful, but not all things build up. Let no one seek his own good, but the good of his neighbor. Key verse. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any question on the ground of conscience. For the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. If one of the unbelievers invites you to dinner and you are disposed to go, eat whatever they put before you without raising any question on the ground of conscience. But if someone says to you, this has been offered in sacrifice, then don't eat it. don't eat it. Does that sound familiar? It sure does. That's, I believe, why Daniel. Now, it's true that Nebuchadnezzar may have had some shellfish and some shrimp, stuff he wasn't supposed to eat in there. But what I know for a fact is that Daniel would have been very careful not to defile himself by worshiping a false idol. And in his mind, the meat that the king is bringing to their table has definitely been offered to an idol. And he said, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. And the reason this is miraculous to me, well, look at verse 15 of chapter 1. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. Do you think the Babylonians knew what they were doing? Did they have this thing down by now? Like, we know what is best to make you good and strong and healthy. I think they probably did. And yet here the Hebrew youths are just eating vegetables and water. And they're somehow getting stronger than the people who are surviving on protein and good fat, because they didn't have processed stuff back then, did they? It's all natural, organic, key word, today. That's a miracle. Again, the providence, the sovereignty of God superintending to deliver these Hebrew boys into positions of prominence. This is not the only time that we see God delivering the Hebrew boys, even when it doesn't make sense. Does it make sense to get thrown into a hungry lion's den and survive all night? Does it make sense to get thrown into a fiery furnace and survive without even the smell of smoke? It doesn't. Does it make sense to eat fruits and vegetables and get fatter and stronger? It doesn't. That is legitimate cherry picking. That's right. Isn't that cool? Daniel said, listen, I'll go along with your name thing. I can't do anything about it, but I ain't doing this. I really wonder what Daniel would have done had the 10 days gone by and they said, look, you're just not cutting it. I believe if my interpretation is correct, or even if it was the dietary restrictions, Daniel's going to say, you know what? I'm not doing it. Because we know that was the kind of guy Daniel was. If he was willing to go to a den of lions over prayer, then he was not about to worship idols over a slab of meat, right? By the way, I'm not going to hit it right now, but that little section where it says, besides the rank idolatry, the real problem lay behind the false gods, go back and read that on your own time. That's really interesting stuff. So, their faithfulness was vindicated. They were given a 10-day probation, and at the end of the 10 days, it was all good, and I've already covered this, but this is evidence of God's faithfulness. So, this is where I really need y'all's help. What's some application for us? These are just the questions I came up with. If you come up with a question, I want to hear it, but let's just do these first. How are you tempted to blend in with the culture? They were trying to force those boys into their culture, weren't they? Do you ever feel like the culture is trying to force your kids to blend in? Man, it's awful. Turn on the TV. You know what? I was watching football today and working on my laptop. And Natalie said, I wish you would pause it or something during the commercials. You know, I remember my mom saying the same type of thing when I was a kid. But commercials are definitely worse now than they were when I was growing up. Definitely worse. These devices right here, our kids get in a lot of trouble with these. A lot of trouble. Do you know where 80% of pornography comes from anymore? Mobile devices. Forget your PC. It's a relic of the past. It's a dinosaur. At school, you listen, we got them at church for how many hours a week? 3, max, 4, maybe. And then they're at home. And then they're at school, where they're not even under your supervision. The culture does not rest. There's a God of this world who wants us, and He wants our kids. What are some obvious ways? What are some obvious ways that we're tempted to blend in with the culture? I want to hear some feedback. Facebook? What's that little fella's name right there? Braden, you're talking about apps these people don't know about, brother. You need to tell your the man right beside you, example number one. But he's right. He's right. You're not cool if you don't. Who's going to talk? Go ahead. Oh, man, that's true. That's true. I'll never forget. Good lesson my father taught me. Oh, I resented it. But I wanted to play baseball so badly. This is not even Sunday. This is Wednesday night. They had practices. I've probably told you all this story before. But, I mean, my dad was in a different position because he was the pastor, too. But really, is that fair that the pastor's kid gets held to a different standard than everybody else? Here I am, a pastor now. Maybe I sound bitter. But it is true. But he said, you're not going to play baseball. If they're going to require you to practice on Wednesday, you're not going to play. So I really resonate with that. And boy, I was so upset. But looking back on it, I see there might have been some wisdom with that. What else? What are some not so obvious ways? Some subtle ways. Think about, huh? Speak on. OMG. Ah, oh boy, we talked about you missed this morning. You know, Natalie's always complaining that buying for boys is easy. Buying for the girls is so hard, especially in summertime when trying to buy a bathing suit or whatnot. Oh, yeah. Hey, you know what? I want to be careful here because Salem is still a sweet little girl, right? Mercy's a sweet little girl. But if I let her wear booty shorts now, what's she going to wear in 3 years? She's going to want to wear booty shorts. I'm just saying, think about these things. It doesn't change overnight. They get bigger slowly. And now Salem's going to go home and ask me, what are booty shorts? Being snobby.
Oh.
Countercultural. That's what we're talking. That's a cultural thing. She's being countercultural. Do you think Daniel ever was accused of being a goody two-shoes? I bet he was. Anything else? You know, it's interesting though. I don't know why women are perceived as being more gossipy than men, but I gotta say, maybe it's more common among the ranks of women. But the worst gossips I've ever known were men. And now maybe that's because I talk to men more too. I don't know. It's all anecdotal at this point. Huh? Enough. You're about to get in trouble. Yes, ma'am. I'd love to see it. Like a code of conduct or something? Right. So, where were you going with that, Miss Kathy? Basic stuff, right. Seize the day. Woo. Yeah. Listen, that impulse, I think every parent feels it. But think about this. Daniel had no choice but to live there, right? He had no choice on all of his Hebrew friends. They had no choice but to be part of that culture. There's a verse in 1 John that says this. We are in the world, not how we do that. Well, we're faithful every day. And I think the big answer is it starts with you and me as parents just modeling it at home. That's really where it begins. But this is good conversation. I do want to ask this one final question. Have you experienced God's faithfulness when you refused to go along with the culture? And I'll start as maybe I need to elaborate by giving an illustration of myself. So when we were living in Bartlesville, there was a hotel, and we had just moved there, and you know, looking for a job. So I put on my suit, and I went knocking. I went to all the places that might be hiring, including all the hotels, and I got a front desk job at Fairfield Inn front desk job. Nothing special, working midnight hour, you know, 12 to 8, something crazy like that. Doing what you can, right? Well, I got promoted to front desk manager. Then I got promoted to assistant general manager of the hotel. And that's when I hit a snag. I might be the proud general manager of the Fairfield Inn and Suites today if this had not happened, instead of your pastor. So there's this all this quality control stuff that has to happen, right? You might not have thought about it, but there's log books that say, we checked this back door to make sure it's shut and locked. We checked the pool to make sure the pH is this. We checked this. We checked this, so on and so forth. Well, the big boss man, the regional fellow, was coming into town. The general manager, her name was Teresa, she said, hey, here's the log books. We haven't been keeping up with the log books. We've, you know, obviously they've been doing it, but we haven't been keeping up with the log books. And it wasn't obvious that they'd been doing it, by the way. That was just her way of trying to cover herself. She said, why don't you just, if you would just take care of this and backdate it, I would appreciate it. So I sweated bullets over that thing. And I took it back to her and I said, I can't do it. I can't do it. And it didn't happen immediately, but she found a reason to fire me like a month later. I don't know how long it was. It was about a month. It wasn't long. And to this day, I know why I got fired. I would not go along with her culture. But you know what? Now I'm here. So the Lord blessed me. How have you experienced the faithfulness of God when you went counterculture? Man, y'all are a bunch of go-alongers, aren't you? Maybe you're right. Okay. That's good. If you didn't hear her, she said there was gossip happening. She wouldn't go along with it. And she may have lost those friends, but she gained a new friend in the process. Anybody brave enough to give an example when you weren't faithful and you paid the price for it? All right, we'll stop now. We could all give one of those, couldn't we? All right, let's... We do have a business meeting to get to, so let's... Did you say something? Oh, I'm sorry. Let's close in prayer, and we'll move into our business meeting. We'll have a 30-second break for those that need to leave. Father...